address that. So again, my name's Chris. I've been working in the renewable energy sector for about 15 years. And again, do oil and gas and all those sorts of other things. And so over the last 15 years, I've been involved both in the research, the primary research, as well as reviewing the literature and reviewing all of the epidemiology studies, all of the, you know, Health Canada and the European and the Australian studies that have been conducted around the world. There are certainly older projects, primarily in the US, some in Canada, where turbines were quite frankly sited too close to people's homes. Okay, so in the past, especially in the US, you would look at 1,000 feet, not 1,000 meters, but 1,000 feet, you know, well under a quarter, like less than a quarter mile from people's homes. There were sound limits that used to be that you could use 55 decibels, 60 decibel sound limits. You could have shadow flicker of hundreds of hours a year because you had five turbines to the east of the house, five turbines to the west, and you were getting a lot of these issues. So what happened, and certainly some of the early European projects, over the last 20 years, there's been a lot of research. I mean, I know some people, I've talked to some of you tonight, that don't necessarily believe the Health Canada study, but Health Canada back in 2012 to 2014 spent over $2 million of our taxpayer money. It was under a Tory government at the time, right, under a Harper government, and Pierre Poilievre was actually the one who sponsored that study as the MP. That study basically helped us to inform us as to what proper setback should be, what proper sound limit should be, and then ultimately in the last 10 years, there's been over 100 other studies around the world on what constitutes a properly sited project for all the issues, infrasound, low frequency noise, audible sound, shadow flicker, EMF, and the like. And what we've seen and what we come to is that the lived experience that we see, what people have, and Shan can tell you more about the sound side on, you know, the sound limit, Saskatchewan doesn't have a sound limit for wind projects. It's actually the only province that doesn't, okay? The sound limit that is common across Canada is 40, no more than 40 decibels outside of somebody's home. If I stop talking for a second, just the hum in the room, the fans going, the furnace and everything else is give or take, we'd be in the sort of 50 decibel range here. So we're less than half the sound limit of that. The setback distances that your RM have, both RMs have, the 1,500 meters, for those of you that are like me, like to work in miles sometimes, that's 1 mile, give or take. So you're at least a mile back from people's homes, at least, you know, 1,500 meters. That is the furthest setback distance I've seen of any project proposed in North America. I've worked in over 26 states, every province that have wind projects. Typically, as these guys were saying before, that 750 meter or half mile was the typical setback distance. Now we're seeing about a kilometer. So when you put all of these things together, your RMs actually have the most stringent sound setback standards of any project that I can dream up. The first time I got a phone call, so there's no way you can build a project at 1.5 kilometers from people's homes. It's just, you're not gonna be able to fit a project in. They have actually made that commitment. There's other considerations that are going on. So have there been people that have health complaints that, you know, real or perceived? Absolutely, and again, especially the last 10 years of research has shown us how to properly site these projects. So that's where we look at today, the modern projects, the turbines, yes, they're getting taller, but we, by these stringent setbacks and all the other requirements, that we're confident that if this project was moved forward in your community, that it will be without health impacts to the local residents. The vast majority of the studies around the world have not been actually paid for by the wind industry. And what they are is, if you look at, you know, the Health Canada study, again, was completely federal funded dollars out of Health Canada from a Tory government. The two lead researchers I might note on that, Dr. Stephen Keith and Dr. Daniel Michaud, are amongst some of the best scientists in the world in this field of study and actually advise the World Health Organization line. The Australian studies similarly were funded by the Australian national government. Instead of being national government scientists, it was researchers, selected independent researchers out of a couple of universities. In the United States, it's the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory associated with Berkeley University. So these studies are, you know, almost primarily done by academic researchers at universities. The funding typically comes from their federal or state governments. So actually the wind industry's paid very little, probably should have paid more for the research than they have. So it is those researchers, and the other thing you can take heart from is that you can read all of those studies, all of the other researchers around the world. Not everybody agrees with the findings of those studies, but when we look at them in their totality, they are up there published for everybody to look at. And what we've seen over the last 10 years, whether you're in Europe, you're in Canada, you're in the US, the findings are remarkably similar, which is what we can take heart from, knowing that when we stay with these stringent setbacks, these very low sound levels, that that's what constitutes a good project. So yeah, the Health Canada study, like any other scientific study, puts some qualifiers to it. And it's not that it can only be applied to Ontario or PEI. What it says is that you can't take the Health Canada study and then universally apply it around the world with it being the only single study. So it does qualify and say that the results are from Ontario and PEI, and that's where I qualify with, now there's been 10 more years of research, whether you're in Europe or Australia or the like, that study and the general findings of that study, along with other research, can then be applied as a body of literature. And so I'll give you some examples. So the Alberta AUC, okay, so the Alberta, any project you want to develop in Alberta, ultimately doesn't just stay with the RMs and the minister, it goes to appeal at the Alberta Utilities Commission. We've been having this discussion with the Alberta Utilities Commission for over 10 years about whether or not the Health Canada study should apply to some extent in Alberta. The answer is yes. So it's not just, you can't just use the Health Canada study alone. And they do have proper qualifiers on it. There's absolutely about, I think there's about four qualifiers in there. So it's, do not use our study alone and universally apply it everywhere. Another 10 years of study, that's where you can have confidence in both the Health Canada study as well as the whole body of literature. I touched briefly on the BPA thing. And now, so it is true that the fiberglass, like any manufacturing of fiberglass, starts with an epoxy resin. And there's basically two epoxies that are put together that then forms the fiberglass shell. If you go to Home Depot, if you go to, you know, your local hardware store, any of the epoxy resin that we all use has BPA in it. Almost all the plastics in your home have BPA in it. These chairs have a fair bit of BPA in the epoxy resin. What happens is when you actually then, and I know the study you're talking about, it was a Norwegian. Unfortunately, the study that got published in Norway by an opposition group is actually got a lot of misleading and false information in it. When you take that BPA epoxy resin and you combine it with the other, you create the fiberglass. It's no longer BPA at that point. It's got a different chemical makeup and structure. And regardless, is that it's bound in that form where it's not going to get into the groundwater, it's not going to get into our bodies, even if you had a blade failure accident. One of the references that I would point you to is the American Clean Power Association has a fact sheet on the BPA and the microplastics. Candidly, I helped them write it. Okay, there's a lot of research around the world done on this to make sure that you're basically, you know, say fiberglass is in like a fiberglass boat or the like. Yes, it's there to make it. It's bound up, and then so even if you had a blade on the ground, it's not going to be released. It's not going to impact people. Absolutely, BPA can cause cancer and other health impacts if it's improperly used, if it's sourced into the environment in an inappropriate way. So we certainly make sure that the way the blades are manufactured, that they're not shedding all of this material into the neighboring fields. You're not going to have impacts on the soil. You're not going to impact the wheat. You're not going to impact cattle. You're not going to impact dairy. So it is true that it starts off that way. It doesn't end up that way. Happy to share more information with you and talk to you further. But in general, it is not, there is that one study out of Norway with which honestly contains false information.
Okay, so we could probably cite that or illustrate or illuminate that. Okay. University of Strathclyde?
The University of Strathclyde study actually is a very good study and did not say what you're referring to. What happened was there was a group out of Norway of non-scientists who then took that study. Again, the fact sheet for the American Clean Power Association has a quote from the actual researchers from Strathclyde saying that they misused that information. Happy to get that to you. There's a lot of it out there that it was just improperly used and misinformation spread on the internet as to what that study actually says. Let's face it, I feel for everybody in the room, right? Like, this is what I do for a living, this is what I get paid to do for a living, this is what I specialize in. It is hard. You go to the internet, we all recognize that. It's hard for me to sit up here for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, throw some facts at you. Why would you believe me, right? I'm getting paid by everyone. So what we're going to try to do, and again, as Sam's described and others, happy to have the conversations individually, happy to provide you with the information that we're talking about up here. Instead of giving you, I can lecture you for 8 hours and give you a great PowerPoint presentation. So certainly anybody that has continuing questions, wants more information, fill it out. And we're happy to continue to have those discussions. So we're trying to do our best to answer the questions in a professional manner, give you the right information. Start of the process, not the end.
We have done extensive bird migration and breeding surveys throughout the project area over the last year. And we have seen that there are a lot of birds obviously migrating through the area. One of the things that we will be doing if the project gets approved post-construction is a post-construction monitoring program. So that means that there would be staff on site walking beneath the turbines to see if there are bird fatalities. And we do expect that there will be low levels of bird fatalities on the project. It is inevitable with wind projects, but generally the levels of bird fatality is quite low. So the project would have something called an adaptive management plan. So that means that at different levels of fatality, various mitigation measures or monitoring programs would kick in. So we would anticipate low levels, but if a high fatality event did occur, or if there were certain sensitive species that were found beneath the turbines, various mitigation measures would apply to the project. So that's how that can kind of be taken care of post-construction, is by using that adaptive management process.
Great. Do you want to touch on it, Dr. Summers?
Sure, yeah, I can address the birds, the concerns about birds and other wildlife. So a big part of taking into consideration the concerns for wildlife, including birds, is the siting of the project. So we've been conducting a lot of wildlife surveys, including vegetation surveys, wetland assessments at the project area since last August. And we've been providing that feedback to Enbridge through the results of our monitoring program. And Enbridge has taken those results into consideration when they are siting the turbines. So they're avoiding sensitive species observations. So for example, if we see a breeding species of a particular bird that requires a setback to make sure it's not harmed, they'll adjust the turbine locations if needed to try and avoid those breeding observations. So as you mentioned, we will likely see low levels of bird fatality at the project. But a lot of the birds, so for example, I know waterfowl might be a concern in the area. So some of the snow geese or Canada geese that might migrate through. Those bird species, we generally see very, very low levels of fatality at wind projects. And that's partially because they migrate at very high heights. So even though these turbines are tall, the birds are migrating at much higher heights than the turbines will be spinning at. They also tend to migrate during the day, so they have an easier time of avoiding the turbines because they can see them and avoid them that way too. So, and as I mentioned in response to a previous question too, there is that adaptive management process. So the province of Saskatchewan has various thresholds that they hold the project to account to. So if bird fatality does rise above, it's a three-tier system, so based on what tier of fatality you see, there would be different mitigation measures or monitoring protocols that are kicked into place. Some of that can include habitat compensation for particular species. So there are various processes in place to address that potential bird fatality for each project.
Yeah, in summary, we have done a lot of assessment to inform where we should site these turbines, and we're going to continue to assess that once this is in operation and make any adjustments as needed based on the rigs.